This is Teddy Roosevelt, just back from charging up San Juan Hill. Damn it, Professor Buzzkill was already at the top, collecting historical evidence, busting myths, and taking names. I have to admit that he's a worthy competitor and a damn fine rough rider. Join me in listening to this episode. It's sure to be bully.
Yes, indeedy. Professor Buzzkill here, busting myths, taking names, ruining your day since the early 60s. We are here again to talk about climate change myths, part two. And we're having a show in part two because some of this stuff is so important it wouldn't fit into one episode. And thank goodness, thank our lucky stars that Dr. Andrew Ramey from Carnegie Mellon is here to take us through the 20th century. How are you, Professor?
Great. The climate's changed a lot since the last time we spoke.
Yes, that's right.
Seeing the first signs of fall out there, the leaves starting to change.
Yeah, mid-September. We want to say to the Buzzkillers, of course, that we're here again with this new innovation we're doing. We're here at Coffee Tree Roasters, one of our favorite coffee shops in town, and you'll hear coffee shop noises in the background. You'll hear maybe some music and people wandering around. So if you hear that, it's not that people are trying to disrupt the show. It's because we are here live. So, Professor, you broaden not only my knowledge of the history of climate change science, but I think the knowledge of the audience here, but also, and of course, the audience of Buzzkillers from last week. So, Professor, last time we talked, we reviewed the history of climate science prior to the 20th century, but I think we should remind the Buzzkills what the big takeaways from that episode was.
Yeah, and it's great to be back at the Buzzkill Institute.
It's a fantastic
satellite location.
Yes, the satellite and Coffee Tree Roasters.
Very happy with my iced coffee. Do you recommend it? there's two things that I'd like to jog everyone's memory on as we head into this episode. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we talked last time about how there's this myth that climate change was a concern that began with the so-called hippie generation in the 1970s. And one of the things that I pointed out was that a lot of these myths surround this idea that humans can't change nature. It's too big, it's too powerful. So one, we want to remember there's this long history of thinkers. You may remember we talked about our old friend Thomas Jefferson, our Scottish philosopher David Hume.
Yeah, those guys, yeah.
Those old guys who thought that humans very well could change the natural world. Mm-hmm. So that's one. The other one is this long scientific foundation, and something that I wish I had spent more time describing in our last episode was the scientific foundation of carbon dioxide and how it gets into the story.
Yeah, that seems to be the biggie that changes everything, the whole understanding of carbon dioxide and then the measurement of how carbon dioxide affects global warming.
So the story about, you know, carbon dioxide, and just to try to give Buzzkillers a sense of where we are now, is carbon dioxide is the primary driver of global warming today. That's been understood for some time. There are other things that get involved, and we start talking about the climate denial. We can talk about how scientists will acknowledge other factors, and then other people will say, well, the role is bigger than you said it was. So we'll get into that. But carbon dioxide is the main culprit in this story, and the history of carbon dioxide is a little bit checkered. So in the 18th century, the theory was all about agriculture. Buzzkillers may remember we talked about how natural philosophers would think that if you cut down the forest and put in agriculture, you get a better climate. Mm-hmm. But by the 19th century, you get scientific experiments that begin to demonstrate that carbon dioxide is capable of absorbing infrared radiation. That's step one. Step two, you get
carbon dioxide is capable of absorbing infrared radiation from the sun, presumably.
Well, actually,
not infrared radiation from the moon.
Yeah. So the radiation is actually coming from the Earth's surface.
Oh.
So okay. I should maybe pull back and not assume too much about the greenhouse effect. When we talk about the greenhouse effect, we're talking about the ability of visible light to penetrate the Earth's atmosphere.
Okay.
Like visible light penetrates the panes of a greenhouse.
Yeah.
Strikes the Earth's surface, strikes a plant, is absorbed, and then infrared, stuff we can't see, infrared radiation, heat comes off of the planet, comes off of the plants, and is trapped by the glass, trapped by the gas, carbon dioxide.
Right, gotcha. Okay. Well, then how did scientists start to figure that out?
Well, that's where we go back to this progression of scientists over the course of the 18th century. Mm-hmm. Early testing, figuring out that we have an ability of carbon dioxide to absorb heat, but then you also get these meteorological societies that are taking measurements of the atmosphere across the planet. And so by the late 1800s, we're talking 1870s, 1880s, the British Empire is important because they're able to establish stations all around the world. So is the United States with stations all across the American West. And you start to build a picture of what the Earth's atmosphere looks like. So by the end of the 19th century, you get some very accurate estimates of the total parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You get an understanding that carbon dioxide can trap heat, and you get the first theorists starting to say, this might explain why the Earth is warmer than it should be if the atmosphere wasn't absorbing heat. So I know I went on
That's good because I don't know, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners don't know.
And so one of the interesting things is this theory gets developed, and by the turn of the 20th century, we talked about our friend the Swedes, Svante Arrhenius, who won a Nobel Prize, helped popularize, though didn't invent the idea of global warming. And then what's really interesting is this idea goes away. And for a brief period, about a generation, scientists discredit the idea that carbon dioxide could be causing global warming.
Okay, so like a lot of other history, a lot of other specialized history, subtopics in history, it's very rarely a simple story, right? There's a lot of back and forth. We talked about, in the last show, we talked about the seeming great advances, and yet people then take a step back, and where they abandon things and start working on other stuff. You rarely go from point A to point B. So this, what's happening to understanding of carbon dioxide seems to be very, very important, and following that same sort of pattern. People studying it, then not studying it, and taking advances and not taking advances?
Yeah, absolutely. We would love it. It would make our jobs a hell of a lot easier if history was a logical progression from point A to point B, if things happened in a simple...
Yeah, but because since it's not, you know, that's why I get the big money. So I want it to be complicated.
Right. So here's the complexity. The complexity is right around the same time that our friend the Swede, you know, publishes Arrhenius. His work, Arrhenius, he makes carbon dioxide the thing. Another group of scientists say, look, based on our measurements, and this was true at the time, based on our measurements, it seems like all the available heat is already being captured by the carbon dioxide currently in the atmosphere. So if we're putting additional carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it doesn't matter because it's already capturing all the heat coming off of the Earth. So they had cruder instruments.
Oh, okay.
And so they didn't understand the full spectrum of heat radiation that's being absorbed by carbon dioxide and the multiple dynamics. I don't want to get too technical here. So sort of the basic version of this is scientists with the instrumentation they had at the time concluded extra carbon dioxide would not affect global warming because all that's already accounted for. So the thing that I want buzzkillers to understand to try to make some sense of this, even in the early 20th century, there's no dispute that more carbon is going into the atmosphere.
Right.
There's no dispute that we're accumulating carbon. There's no dispute that carbon dioxide absorbs heat and contributes to the greenhouse effect. There's no dispute that carbon dioxide is keeping the planet warmer than it should be if we didn't have this atmosphere with these qualities that it has. The dispute is, based on the instruments available, scientists thought excess carbon dioxide wouldn't trap any more heat in. All the heat that we have is already being captured by all the carbon dioxide already in the atmosphere. So if we're looking for causes of climate change, it must be something else like sunspots, like wobbles in the earth, other factors.
Yeah, all those other things we talked about at the beginning of last week's show that people sort of throw out as possible reasons for any major climate change.
That's right.
And this is still, we're still not talking about the 19 early decades of the 20th century.
Yeah, we're in the World War I era. We're understanding measurements globally are showing the Earth's average temperature is rising. People are starting to get that picture. But at this time, carbon dioxide's role is not perfectly understood. It's just not seen as the driving factor.
Well, how does that get back into the scientific agenda, so to speak? Because we know now that it is.
Absolutely. And this is where the environment really plays an exciting role in our story. As an environmental historian, one of the things that I love studying is all the ways that the non-human world, nature, for lack of a better word, can change the course of human history. So in the 1930s, a funny thing happened. The Earth kept getting hotter, and all the other theories didn't track the observed data. So from 1934 to 1938, the observed weather patterns were the hottest years on record. There were some stations in the British Empire that had records going back 180 years, and these were the hottest years on record. So there was this British scientist. He was actually an engineer. So give, you know, I'm at Carnegie Mellon, great
engineering
school.
Big shout out to the engineers.
Big shout out to our friends in engineering. And so this engineer, Guy Stewart Callender, British engineer, he started thinking, this doesn't make sense. These parts don't fit together. We're seeing an observed warming. The other theories aren't working. It must be CO2. So he started looking back at CO2 and realized that in the time that had passed since like the World War I era to the 1930s,
right,
the instrumentation had gotten better. And it turns out there was actually more heat radiation being captured than scientists had initially thought. So he revitalizes this theory and says, look, we've had the hottest years on record. The other explanations don't add up. We have to go back and look at the role of CO2.
Okay, now this is something, this sounds to me like something you hear in the headlines today, because it's always, this is the hottest year, these are the hottest months, these are the hottest 3 years, 5 years we've had in the last so-and-so. In particular, 2018, 2019, 2020, will be 2020, seem to be breaking records every year.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the fun things about being a buzzkiller is you get to say, no, actually, not the first time this has happened. We've had, you know, record highs before. We've, like, I hate the word unprecedented, because so rarely is something actually unprecedented. Yeah. You just have to look for the precedents. And so, yeah, you're absolutely right. It sounds like something we're hearing today. Hottest years on records, records being broken all across the country. The Brits are doing something weird. But this is back in the 1930s. I do want to note for those people who are going to be nitpicky that at this time, Guy Callender didn't have a global average temperature. He was working from a pretty robust data set, but not totally complete. So he was making some estimates, but his estimates were very accurate. And he kept pointing out over and over again that these other explanations of global warming, whether you're talking about sunspots, whether you're talking about the tilt of the Earth's axis as it wobbles around the sun, these just aren't fitting the observed data. The world's temperatures are continuing to go up,
right,
in line with CO2 emissions. And so he is extremely influential with putting this back on the agenda, especially for the next generation of scientists who really pull the theory together in the 1950s.
Is this breaking out into sort of public concerns or the public media or public discussion about global warming, or is this still, you know, just being just a concern of scientists?
Yeah, this is a great point. This is one of those inflection moments where it starts to reach the popular consciousness. Uh-huh. And Callender himself is a really good stand-in for this process. When he started in the 1930s, he thought, kind of like some of our older friends, that global warming would be good. He was worried about a potential return of glaciers, because by this time, other branches of science are advancing, and one of the things that we'll get to in the climate denial section is there should be another ice age. And so people will say, oh, don't worry, there's an ice age right around the corner. We don't have to do anything.
Oh, right, okay.
With respect to global warming,
because it's an ice age.
Yeah, we're saving ourselves with global warming. And so he was actually relieved in his calculations to find, like, okay, no ice age is going to happen. But that relief quickly, I say as a historian, over a decade plus, as a real human, is a long time.
Yeah, that's a blink of an eye for us,
So he realized these changes were happening a lot faster than expected. And it's really in this post-World War II era that we get global concerns. These record warm temperatures in the 1930s were broken by new record highs in the 1940s and 50s. And the other interesting historical convergence is nuclear weapons. And you might not expect
nuclear weapons.
Nuclear weapons.
Well, of course, you're talking about the 40s and World War II's.
The serious
advent of nuclear weapons. Yeah.
Atmospheric testing in the 1950s was a big concern.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And so this was a big scare. Radiation appearing all over the place, and this heightened popular consciousness to be aware of global threats. So, you know, we talked about in the last episode how the broader culture could accommodate an idea of humans changing nature. Well, in the 1950s, the broader culture was becoming newly aware of global threats. Nuclear war was one of them. Nuclear winter is another interesting one that we can talk about. But climate change was able to sort of dovetail with this idea that the industrial development of humanity has reached the point where it can now threaten the very globe we live on. So with the development of nuclear weapons, with the development of computers, we get more and more accurate models of warming, accurate projections of radiation, tons of funding for science. Again, mm-hmm, we talk about the state. There's a ton of money. Like this idea of the individual genius is belied by the fact that there's so much federal funding of science in the 1950s that supports monitoring, supports computer development to really start to make this come together.
When you're saying this thing about nuclear testing of nuclear weapons, it reminded me that one of the things that JFK and other people are pushing at the time is what they call the degradation of the atmosphere. Not only is the spread of nuclear weapons possibly a bad thing for in terms of additional warfare or more, you know, more increasing likelihood of warfare, but the atmosphere is going to degrade if we keep doing this. So is this one of those things that kind of, again, there's this theory of global warming, and now because of all these flashpoints, pardon the expression, because of nuclear war, it's entering the public mind and the public discussion?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd love to point out a couple of key examples here. By the 1950s, you have really popular media, and this is something for people of my generation, we have a hard time conceiving that there's like one newspaper that's famous that everyone reads. Well, yeah. But there was that newspaper in the 1950s. It was called the Saturday Evening Post. It was a big deal. Everyone read
magazine,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe some of the older listeners might have a copy. If you're a younger listener, go talk to your grandpa or grandma, ask in the attic. I'm sure there's
great grandpa.
So the Saturday Evening Post runs this article on global warming, and it is sensationalist as all get out. There's this fear of, you know, dramatic change, populations moving across the world, playing out in the Cold War context. So that's just one example. Another one is you have this new generation of scientists that's a bit more conversant with the popular media. There's a guy named Gilbert Plass. He's one of these new generations. He's influenced by Guy Callender, that British engineer who brought CO2 back onto the agenda. And he calls CO2 emissions a planetary experiment. This is where you get into some of that sort of concerned rhetoric. For scientists, that's not something you toss around lightly.
Right.
So in 1956, talking about this planetary experiment, he says, and I'd like to read you this quote because I think it's pretty relevant. He says, quote, "If at the end of this century, measurements show that carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere has risen appreciably, and at the same time, the temperature has continued to rise throughout the world, it will be firmly established that carbon dioxide is an important factor in causing climate change."
Now that sounds to me like a 1986 quote, but it's a 1956 quote.
Right. This is the 50s. This is the era of conservative culture. Everyone goes to the drive-in and has a malt soda, and they're worried about teenagers and large cars. Like, we're not at like radical environmentalism
yet. No. But did anybody listen to this stuff? Did anyone notice that? Well, these scientists are saying these things. This is a dangerous thing because, as you say, it is an era of popular science. You know, there's all sorts of things, especially when the space exploration thing starts, or is this something that sounds too techy, too complicated, and people don't pay attention to it?
No, this is the crazy thing about this period in the 50s. It's at the height of the Cold War, 1957, the Russians launched Sputnik.
Mm-hmm.
People in America are freaking out. So at the highest level of U.S. politics, presidents, senators are listening to scientists. Scientists have unprecedented access to the halls of power. And remember that, because when we get to the denial, well, we're going to want to remember this fact.
Climate change denial.
Yes, thank you. So these scientists have a ton of credibility. Major politicians were listening to what they had to say. One of the biggest turning points comes in 1965 when Lyndon Johnson discussed climate change in an address to Congress.
Well, Lyndon Johnson, you mean, hey, LBJ, you know, how many hippies can you alienate today?
Yeah, I mean, LBJ, you don't get much more anti-hippie than him. Like this,
or at
is,
least the public perception of him.
Yeah, or that's at least fair enough. Mainstream science, senator from Texas, vice president, or he's not on a radical fringe. So back in 1965, there is this thing called the President's Scientific Advisory Committee, and this was back before the proliferation of committees and things and before the internet, so people actually read these documents. And so LBJ read this, and he was freaked out. It had a lot of scary predictions about the atmosphere, what you said about Kennedy earlier and the degradation of the atmosphere. So one of the items on the agenda was carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm, LBJ gives this speech to Congress, and he calls out global warming by name, 1965. Again, indulge me in a direct quotation, a primary source to my students who are listening. Quote, air pollution is no longer confined to isolated places. This generation has altered the composition of the atmosphere on a global scale through radioactive materials and a steady increase in carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels. Unquote. So what I really like about that quote is you see that linking of climate change, nuclear radiation, these global concerns, people fully aware that humanity has the capacity to not just change the global environment, but to damage it to the point where it might even risk human habitation.
But this is astounding to me. So what you're saying is by the 60s, the 1960s, and 65 is barely within my lifetime, the global warming is firmly established. Concerns about warming planet are in the mainstream. LBJ is saying it took Congress, right? This is not something that starts in, again, the, you know, the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, it has much deeper roots. And I think where one of the ways we might get confusion is instead of the emergence of concerns about climate change, this is the culmination of 150 mm-hmm. years of science. Mm-hmm. Since 1800, scientists have been refining and understanding the role of carbon dioxide and how it absorbs heat, how it circles the globe, its concentrations, the production of it, understanding how the atmosphere works. So by the 1960s, you have a really robust model of what's going to happen if we continue pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and people are starting to raise the alarm. And at the highest levels of government, the president himself, we have a concern being expressed to Congress.
Okay, this is a good place to take a quick break for station identification. So let's do that, and we'll be back, Buzzkillers, right after this.
Hello, this is Lady Buzzkill. If you simply must follow my husband's deluded podcast hobby, you can also find him on Facebook, Twitter at BuzzkillProf, and Instagram at Professor Buzzkill. You might go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com if you're so inclined, and support him on Patreon. Subscribe to his email list, if you must, and shop the Buzzkill bookshelf. The only thing that seems to keep him from making more noise and frightening the horses is that the Professor Buzzkill Show is part of Entertainment One's podcast network. And of course, it's available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and all major podcast apps. Finally, I suppose I should thank you for listening. So, thank you for listening.
Okay, we're back with Dr. Andrew Ramey from Carnegie Mellon talking about climate change. Now, Professor, when we left this, we were just talking about how things have really expanded, how it's even gotten to the point where LBJ is talking to Congress about this in the 60s, finally reaching the 60s and the 70s. Take up the story from there.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that happens in the 70s is there's actually global cooling.
Wait a minute. How did that happen?
Well, this is a very fun story, and I'll try to keep it brief, but there's this global cooling scare in the 1970s, and there's a nugget of truth to the myth in that global temperatures did decrease in the 70s. This is not a big deal. There's natural variation in climate and in temperatures. It's not a straight line upward. So there's this period in the 70s where it does cool off, global temperatures decrease. However, average temperatures in the 1970s are still way higher than they were in the 19th century.
Although, so this is a dip in an otherwise upward trend, so to speak.
Absolutely. That's a great way to think of it.
Curve or whatever. Okay.
Yeah, just a minor zig and a much larger zag.
Okay. Because people on the Facebook have been saying, make sure you talk about global cooling as if that's the, you know, an equal to what we're talking about in global warming.
Yeah, and this is where some of these myths of denial start coming in, very earnest, sincere, others a bit more sinister. So, like I said, variation in climate, this is natural. We expect there to be some years are hotter than others. The overall trend is still up. One of the things that happened in the 1970s, a lot of smog, industrial pollution, and there's some evidence to suggest this was helping cool off the planet a little bit, but there's other factors as well, but the smog is a popular idea. We produce all this smog. It blocks sunlight from reaching the earth because the air is so dirty. Uh-huh. So there's less sunlight coming in. That means less sunlight's being absorbed in the earth and radiated back out as heat. Therefore, the earth cools a little bit. And this has been documented in the past with like volcanoes. Oftentimes, after a volcanic explosion, there's so much soot an ash that gets thrown up into the atmosphere that it causes the Earth's temperature to drop. So that's a fun little science digression. What this means as far as the history is concerned, that a lot of popular media picked up this story and ran with it, like the return of the Ice Age.
I remember
the South.
This. Yeah, yeah.
Like there were these crazy articles about like we're all going to have to move to the Sahara and irrigate it to survive the next Ice Age.
Right.
And it's laughable. It's insane. But remember the Cold War context. You also
We're talking about ice sheets coming down.
That's right. Know? But the thing is, that's not what scientists thought. And here in the 70s, you start to see a really startling disconnect between what will sell newspapers, what will sell magazines, and what the scientists are saying.
Okay.
So you can take the fact of a brief decreasing trend, a couple of years where temperatures go down, you can take that out of context and then say, look, there's this problem with global cooling. If you look at scientific papers, and plenty of people have done this, if you look at the scientific papers that were written in the 1970s, the vast, vast majority predicted continued warming. Only 7% of papers published in the 1970s predicted we were heading towards an ice age. So you've got a roughly 93% consensus that, yeah, we're all predicting warming.
Right. Okay. So it's even at the time, it doesn't hold much scientific water, at least in the scientific community, as you're saying.
Absolutely. But this is where you can start to have the denial creep in.
Oh, wait. So climate denialists, That's also a relatively old thing. We're still talking about the 70s.
Yeah, we're still in the 70s.
The years of Farrah Fawcett Major.
So here's what
don't know anymore.
I'm going to try really hard to have empathy for some climate denialists, which is not easy for me because my generation is the generation that's going to live with the consequences.
Yeah. And also, you know the fact that it's not true.
Play a role in my worldview.
Climate change denial is not true.
So, but having sympathy, there are a lot of scientists in the Cold War who were not climate specialists. So there's another big trend happening, which is the specialization of these fields. So in the early days, you could be a geologist and a physicist and a chemist and a mathematician and a senator. Like, it was crazy.
Yeah, yeah, in the 18th century, 19th century,
yeah,
sure.
Even early 20th century a little bit. But by post-World War II, you know, massive expansion in scientific endeavor, tons of federal funding for this. Again, the space race. Tons of technological development to beat the Soviets. So at the peak of this period, you have some credible scientists who were deep into the mythology of America and the rightness of the American cause. And you had some Cold War physicists who started to think that, you know, no, there's some doubt here. And again, these are not climate scientists. These are other scientists, physicists, literal rocket scientists, so smart guys, but who saw the call to reduce climate change as being anti-American, because how could something so good and so pure as the American quest for freedom and liberty produce something bad, right?
This is an ideology. This is an amazing sort of jump to make, you know, a mental jump for them to make that the American, you know, they see all this science, but they say, oh, no, the American way, the American advances are so great, it can't have any of these drawbacks.
Well, one of the really interesting networks is there's this thing called the Marshall Institute, and it's funded by conservative thinkers, some of them connected to the tobacco industry, and they want to support strategic defense initiatives. And so one of their big causes is backing Ronald Reagan's Star Wars program. So Ronald Reagan,
this is an 80s thing.
We're now going from the 70s into the 80s. So there's some discussion, debate, global cooling, you know, temperatures start picking back up, but there's enough uncertainty that if you wanted to forcefully argue against global warming, against the current of the rest of scientific consensus, you could pick and choose. You could cherry pick a couple of data points.
Gotcha.
And so when Reagan comes into office, he has this ambitious plan for this thing called Star Wars.
Buzzkillers may
know, not the Death Star, but lots of rocketry and sophisticated weapons to beat the Soviets. And so this institute, the Marshall Institute, starts providing the ideological justification for all of this defense spending. Mm-hmm. And they employ these old physicists, rocket scientists from, you know, the 1950s and 60s who are maybe out of the scientific mainstream, but they're big names. They were, you know, they were once in their prime. They're like, you know, Joe DiMaggio fading away to liver cancer or whatever killed him.
Sorry, Mrs. DiMaggio.
Yeah, sorry. So you have these guys who are past their prime, but they're big names, and they're super pro-American. And once the Soviet Union falls, they're looking for like another cause, and they find it in fighting the left wing hippies.
Oh, okay.
And this is where we start to get that myth of climate change being a product of the hippies and an extreme ideology. Okay.
And from the public side, you can see the public hears all this stuff and they think, oh, that's a scientist telling me this. They don't necessarily break down the specialties in science and saying, that's a scientist, but yeah, it's a rocket propulsion scientist. He doesn't know anything about the climate change science.
Absolutely. That's an excellent point. I wish I had thought to make that point myself.
Well, you know, that's why I get the big money.
That's why it's the Buzzkill Institute and not the Ramey Institute. But seriously, that point about science is super important. I think it's fair to say that the average person in the 1980s, late 1970s, could not tell, you know, a climate science specialist from, you know, an ecological biologist, from a paleontologist.
No, and there's no reason why they should. You know, it's not exactly the most important thing. I'd rather people go out and vote, you know, and things like that.
But what's really crazy to this story, what blows my mind, is these old rocket scientists, cold warriors, pro-America to the hilt, they saw regulation of American industry as a threat to the American way of life, which was the big upholder of liberty and freedom in the world.
Right, right.
In some ways, these guys had a historical worldview that America was the great shaper of freedom in history, and to question America is to question that whole project.
Well, and also a lot of them take it as a natural thing, that this is either God-directed or nature-directed, that America will be the country and culture that brings this to the world.
Yeah, and I've been very vague here, so I'll give you a specific name. There's a guy named Fred Singer. He's a climate... He's a climate denialist. He is a physicist. That's his background and specialty. He's famous because he's a rocket scientist. He helped the U.S. build a lot of awesome weapons back in the day. And so even though he's past his prime as a scientist, the thing that he's got going
even
for
him... climate science is not his field.
Climate science is not his field. He's past his prime as a scientist. He's, you know, old and gray at this point. But he's connected to power in Washington.
And he's willing to tell
people in Washington what they want to hear. One of the really crazy stories is at the end of the Reagan administration, George W. Bush takes over, Bush 1.
Isn't that George H.W. Bush?
George, you're right. Sorry. Thanks for correcting me. I had that backwards. George H.W. Bush.
You got to have your Bushes correctly here. Correct order in the
Bushes. I'm not a botanist. I can't tell one Bush from the other.
Yeah, talk about scientific
specialty. Yes. Scientific history would be the specialty. So George Herbert Walker Bush... He's actually kind of an environmentalist. He's an old, dying breed of Republican. Wow. Yeah. Read my dissertation. There are a lot of Republican environmentalists. Fascinating.
No, don't read the dissertation. Just go to the blog post about this episode.
So he's actually willing to listen. And he calls for studies on this issue. He wants, kind of like Lyndon Johnson had back with the President's Scientific Advisory Commission.
Right, right.
He says, okay, scientists, bring me the state of the science. I want to do something about this issue. So he convenes this task force, and this guy, Fred Singer, gets himself on the task force, and he gets to handpick a few of his buddies who have a similar worldview. Uh-huh. And so the task force writes this report, but instead of being one joint report that they all sign off on, they can't agree on the conclusion about what to do with climate change.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So each author writes their own chapter. And this is very unusual. Usually it's co-written, co-authored. There's a consensus. If it's a scientific publication, it's peer-reviewed. But this special report for President Bush had individual chapters. And so what Singer does is he writes a couple of chapters with his friends that are saying there's too much uncertainty, we don't know what's going on, and then he writes the executive summary.
Which is the only thing anyone reads.
And so in the executive summary, he says, there's too much uncertainty. There's these other theories that might be going around. We've had global cooling. It would be unwise and too expensive to try to do something now. And this is really the origins of some of the main lines of climate denial we hear. And you can interpret Singer charitably, you can interpret him uncharitably, but he took some of the inherent uncertainty in science, the very nature of scholarly endeavor, and said, we can't do anything. We should not act because it would be too expensive to try to change our economy when we don't really know if this is a problem.
Okay, and people will go and read just his executive summary or just one of his chapters and pull that out and say, well, this is what the government report about this conclusion.
Not just the government report, but the big physicist, the Superman. We go back to this problem with like the theory of the great man, you know, yeah. why it's problematic. Because if you're a president and you buy into that great man theory and this physicist who you know who's been around and has been involved in the Cold War and has a long distinguished career, he's a big name. Even you as a president might not know that a physicist is not qualified at all to talk about climate science. Just like I'm not qualified at all to talk about the history of the British Empire. That would be wildly outside of my area of expertise. But, you know, all joking aside, so you have a guy with access who's willing to cherry pick some facts, at best, at worst, manipulate them, and present something that reinforces what the first Bush administration wanted to hear, which is that, no, we don't have to do anything. We don't know yet. It will be too costly, too expensive.
Okay, so again, this is late 80s, early 90s, before the 92 election.
That's right.
Is when this whole no consensus argument comes up.
Yes. Period in the late 80s, early 90s, where there's willingness to act. You could say there was the potential for a bipartisan consensus, you know, Republican president willing to do something. But he gets the science that he wants to hear from a physicist, and so as a result,
he gets the science from an impressive group of scientists, at least on paper.
Exactly, an impressive looking group of scientists who are not actually specialists in the field. And so we see this idea get amplified over and over again. Where if you're in the media, like, look, when people say climate scientists, you know, 99% of climate scientists have consensus on global warming. A lot of the so-called denialists, they're not specialists in climate. They've got their scientific degree in something else entirely. So,
right.
You know,
not necessarily saying that they're mail order degrees, but they might be in physics or biology or something.
Or economics. You get a lot of economics, and that's something that I haven't touched on, but, you know, there's a lot of people who use economic theory to argue that it's too expensive to do anything about climate change, and this was one of Fred Singer's early arguments. He brought in some economists to basically discount future costs against the current dollar. I don't want to get into it, but the idea of discounting future costs versus what we have now means we shouldn't take any action because it'll be cheaper to deal with it in the future. And as long, you know, it's, you know, the sign of my favorite bar, free beer tomorrow, just like, well, don't worry, it'll be cheaper. We'll do it tomorrow. So it's always putting it off. But what this whole thing is, if you take it as a whole, these questions about science, there's always some uncertainty. They make it seem like there's this big problem. There's no consensus. And that's just BS.
Oh, well, wait a minute now, Professor. This is a PG show.
Well, of course, by BS, I mean bad storytelling.
Oh, bad. Okay.
And I hate bad storytelling. I can sniff it out. I can smell bad storytelling a mile away.
All right. Well, it's certainly something we won't tolerate here at the Buzzkill Institute, and we're not going to tolerate bad storytelling. So let's just close it out here for the story as you've built it up to the end of the 20th century. What kind of final thoughts can you leave the Buzzkillers with?
Well, I hope I leave them a little bit curious. There's a lot of reading. Let's check the Buzzkill bookshelf. We can dig deep. And, you know, you can go all the way back to Thomas Jefferson and look at his theories of climate change, read the Notes on Virginia. You can, you know, read the IPCC report. Like, there's plenty of...
Wait, the what?
the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The signature authoritative body on this issue. It won't... You know, that's free and online. But there's so much to dig into. It's such a rich history. It goes back so far. And understanding that context and understanding how these scientific ideas evolved and matured can inoculate us in some ways to bad storytelling.
Okay, now we have some questions from the audience about our 20th century show, this part two of our Buzzkill shows on climate change. Yes, sir. Wait, I recognize you from last week. You were the first, in fact, you were the first Buzzkiller to ever ask a question live here at the Buzzkill Institute. Will you tell the Buzzkillers again what your name is?
Sure, I'm happy to be back. My name's Jesse Edelman. My question is, there has been some recent articles, discoveries of what ExxonMobil had done for research on climate change in 1977. ExxonMobil, of course, after that, decided that the research that they did, which would actually prove that global climate change was happening and it was real, decided to fund many kind of think tanks to put out denial of global climate change. Can you speak to the influence of industry in the global climate change denial movement?
Absolutely. This is a really important point. I'm glad you brought up Exxon. They're a critical actor in this story. And I'll just add that the history goes back much deeper. I mentioned on the show, I hate the word unprecedented. I just get my hackles up whenever I hear it. So this move by Exxon is not unprecedented. If you'll remember, I talked about Lyndon Johnson and his president's scientific advisory committee. They published this report, and this was back when people read reports thoroughly and you know, talked about them and discussed them.
Pre-YouTube days.
Pre-YouTube days. And so there's this trade group called the American Petroleum Institute. And wouldn't you know that the chairman of the American Petroleum Institute read this report and was freaked out. And he gave a talk to a gathering of industry types saying this is a big problem. So your Exxon report is part of a longer history of organizations understanding the potential bad PR to damage what they're doing and threaten their business. So that's one part to your answer. The other part that's really interesting is what this reminds me of so much is the tobacco industry and the way in which the tobacco industry knew very early on that their products would cause cancer. And so they funded bad science. Like one of the great ironies of the whole global warming debate is there's this term, junk science. You might hear it. Global warming is junk science. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I heard that. The irony is,
you hear it an awful lot from non-scientists.
You hear it from non-scientists. And so these think tanks would fund research by oftentimes non-specialists to just muddy the waters. There's an excellent book that will surely be up on the Buzzkill bookshelf. It's called Merchants of Doubt. There was a movie made about it. It's an excellent, well-written history of the denial industry. You could call it denial for hire. By the 1990s, there's a whole book that's published on like how to confuse people about science because it's really difficult to understand science. And there's a whole thing more recently about the erosion of journalists and having fewer specific scientific reporters. But I'm ranting here, so I'll wrap it up and just say thank you for pointing that out. It's part of a long historical trend. An industry played a major role funding think tanks to muddy the waters about actual science.
Okay, and yes, ma'am, what would you like to ask Dr. Ramey?
Hi, my name is Emily. So my question is, after hearing this discussion last week and this week, is there hope? Because it seems like there's not a lot of hope and there's not a lot that we can do. But what can we do?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a lot of times the way we talk about the environment, the way we talk about climate, is really depressing. And I get depressed and I feel hopeless. And there's no point in sugarcoating it. It is a really scary situation. The climate is warming quickly. And right now, at this particular moment in time, a lot of elected leaders in a lot of countries are not taking it as seriously as they should. I think what hope there is that we're starting to come up with some technical solutions. So there are ways that we can adapt. There's ways that we can mitigate damage, but we have to have the political will to implement it. The technical challenges are not that great. So if there's hope, there's hope that in many democracies around the world, we know buzzkillers are from all over the country, we don't want to be too U.S.-centric here, that if we elect political leaders who are committed to seeing this through and we hold them accountable, we can have the political will to implement the technical changes. Some technical changes that come to mind. I mentioned this last week when the topic of methane came up, but we have to eat less meat. One of this very easy, basic, simple things we can do is reduce our red meat consumption. Here in the States, that's hard because we think of red meat as being like integral to the American way and you have a steak for dinner every night, but that's insane. Cows waste, I shouldn't say waste, let's be a bit more neutral here morally. Cows consume a lot of water. The production of meat is very energy intensive, both in terms of transporting it all around the globe. A lot of it's grown down in the Amazon, which is burning. So if everyone had one less steak and one more quinoa burger or black bean burger, tofu, pick your veggie. Heck, I would settle for chicken at this point. You know, I'll meet you halfway, buzzkillers. Just swap out one hamburger for one chicken patty, and that can do a lot right there. Obviously, driving less helps. Thinking about population as a whole helps. Those can be radical, scary solutions, but there are options on the table. We just have to have the will to implement them. And I do think speaking as a millennial, we have a generational awareness that this is a problem we're going to have to solve. And I think there is some rising political will. Whether or not it's going to come around in time, I don't know. And I think a lot of what we're going to have to look at is mitigation. Poor nations, poor people living in flood-prone areas. And we're going to have to think as much about how we mitigate the effects of climate change, which is happening right now. It's no longer a faraway concern. It's occurring all around us. We have to think both in terms of mitigating the consequences for our most vulnerable people and nations, while also taking steps to reduce what we can. One of the quotes that has stuck with me for a long time, credit my dad, there's no situation that's so bad that your own stupidity can't make it any worse. So let's at least not make it worse. There's my hope.
Okay, and Buzzkillers, we are going to put a number of different links to, well, links to a number of different resources about how to help this all come about. So again, thanks to Dr. Amy, and thanks to our wonderful audience here at Coffee Tree Roasters. And Buzzkillers, we will speak to you next week.